Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast about politics. My name is Corey Hazelhurst, and with me is my partner in propaganda, Steve Haynes.
Hello!
This is our first podcast of 2017. It's the start of a new series which has the theme of personal responsibility. At the start of a new year, we all try and take responsibility for our lives with New Year's resolutions. What resolutions should our politicians take in 2017? We're discussing that in approximately 37 seconds. Start with our Prime Minister, Theresa May, and we've got three New Year's resolutions that we think she should have. So the first one is get a Brexit plan.
Brexit being clearly the biggest question in UK politics at the moment. You know, it would be quite good if the government would actually outline what its agenda is in a very clear way. Now, if you are actually paying attention to a number of things that the government is saying, you can actually identify that there is actually a plan of some sort there, or what looks like to be the start of a plan. So, for instance, yesterday, Prime Minister May was going around saying, we're making bold steps to create a new trade treaty with New Zealand. Now, the fact that the government is going down that route means we're not going into the customs union. Because if we're a part of the European customs union, we cannot do our own trade deals. The government is saying that we need to withdraw, we need to have limits on immigration and freedom of movement, which is a central freedom for the European Union, which means no single market membership. Mm-hmm. So we will be going for a harder Brexit on that as well. If you look at all of the little details, it's like one of those dot-to-dot puzzles. You start from one end and you kind of go through it all. You do end up with a rough outline of what Brexit will look like, but the problem is because what Brexit is going to look like is a hard Brexit, and that's not necessarily something that's going to be an easy sell across the entirety of the country, especially factions of the Tory party as well, where you do still have some very strident pro-EU people in there, the likes of Nicky Morgan, Anna Soubry. They're not necessarily going to go down quietly on this sort of stuff, so they need to try and find a way to bring them in, bring them on board in some way with the agenda other than just the notion of collective responsibility and this is what the people voted for.
I kind of agree with that, and that goes with, it's what Stephen Bush has been saying for a while. Mm. Stephen Bush, the new statesman, and he says that actually Theresa May's made her Brexit plans quite clear. So one of them is that Britain is going to have control over its borders, immigration, as you've said, and the other is that Britain shouldn't be subject to the European Court of Justice. The problem with that is that if, as you say, if Britain does not sign up to free movement of labour, Britain cannot be part of the single market, which is what Britain does 80% of its trade is. May's got a very difficult position, partly in terms of party management, like you say, but also in terms of trying to manage the expectations of big business. If May says that Britain will sign up to the single market, it's going to annoy a lot of people in the Tory grassroots and in Parliament too.
I mean, Michael Gove came out a couple of days ago basically setting a standard by which he was going to be measuring Brexit against, which basically was all of the criteria for a hard Brexit. So no customs unions, no freedom of movement, all of that sort of stuff.
Yeah, let's be honest. If May decides to sign to the single market, Nigel Farage will cry betrayal and John Redwood and Ian Duncan Smith will try and set fire to things.
Yes,
that's what's going to happen. However, if May rules out joining the single market, the pound will plummet, as happens whenever May seems to talk about Brexit. It happened after she talked to Sophie Ridge on Sky on Sunday. And that is a problem for her as well. And as you say, it would also annoy a lot of pro-business people. There was a leaked memo in November saying there's no Brexit plan. Ivan Rogers, who was Britain's ambassador to the EU, in effect, wasn't he?
Yeah,
and he resigned saying there was muddled thinking on Brexit. And that's probably why I think everyone is so scared to say things, because
it's going to have some kind of negative repercussion. And to be honest, in terms of, you know, making statements which will damage the economy, you know, it's in a lot of ways you can argue it's quite right that the government doesn't go around making those sorts of statements. And indeed, that's one of the critiques that's been thrown at Trump, that his little Twitter rants against Toyota and things are completely unjustified and very bad overall for the American economy.
But it does seem that Theresa May is trying to act on this news resolution that we've given her. It's good that she's acting on our advice already.
Clearly.
It looks like on Tuesday she's going to give a speech on Brexit. We'll be reacting to that speech on our website, notenoughchampagne.com. The second resolution we've got for her is stop being a control freak.
Yeah. If you kind of delve into the depths of, you know, Westminster Kremlinology, and Theresa May has a massive reputation for being a bit of a control freak. In some ways, that served her quite well. I suspect the only reason she's been able to survive the Home Office. The Home Office is normally where politicians go to end their careers because it just consumes them. I think her control freakery and the control freakery of her two closest advisors went some way to enabling them to kind of get through that and actually do things and achieve things in that department. The problem is, it's one thing when you're the elected politician running a department and the people that you're overseeing are a couple of junior ministers and the civil servants who are there to advise and serve you.
One junior minister probably being a Lib Dem, you could probably ignore anyway.
Yeah, probably. But when you're Prime Minister, you're dealing with a lot of other people who have got around the cabinet table, who all have their own ideas, who all have their own opinions, who all have their own departments to back them up as well. So it's not like you're just able to steamroll over them. And in fact, in a load of instances, they're going to be better informed than you are.
And who really want her job.
Yes, in the case of at least one or two of them. Boris. And you can, there's already been kind of some various kind of tittle-tattle kind of coming out. I think specifically Nick Timothy, who is the one of Theresa May's close advisors. Timothy tends to drive more of the policy kind of agenda of things. I think he's more of the vision man. And I think being the vision man, he has been sticking his oar into everything. As a result of that, lots of things are having to go across the Prime Minister's desk, which otherwise normally wouldn't do, especially in comparison to Cameron, which means that sign-off has to be achieved for every last little thing. That's not a good way to run a government. It's not very efficient. It stops people doing things. It stops people working off of their own initiative. Cameron and Blair were accused of running kitchen cabinets. Three or four people who were making all the decisions.
And it was on a sofa. That's the key thing, which means terrible things happen on sofas.
Obviously, yeah. Mm. But with May, it seems to be more along the lines of it's just her way or the highway. You know, yes, you're the Prime Minister. Yes, you're the leader of your party. Yes, technically everybody that you're working with is your subordinate. But anybody who's run a business or works in a business will tell you that you can outrank everybody all you like. At the end of the day, to get things done, it does involve compromise. It does involve actually bringing people along with you for the journey.
And a certain amount of delegation.
Absolutely.
You can't run literally anything.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you don't trust your subordinates, whether those subordinates are junior ministers or, you know, the foreign secretary, well, you're not going to get very far. Because you need to trust those people so that those people will trust you. And if you don't start trusting them, that's when the likes of Boris Johnson will actually start finding ways to needle you and try and undermine your position.
Last week in The Economist, there was an interesting profile on Theresa May, which we'll link to in the show notes. And that called her Theresa Maybe. Because of the logjam that you're talking about, it's very easy to see Britain in 2018 or 2019 in a little bit of a shambles because there's a complete decision logjam, not much is happening. We haven't really seen much of the Brexit ramifications. When that starts to come about in 2018, 2019, if there's still this indecision at the top, you can see the press turning on Theresa May and that narrative, like there was for Gordon Brown, where he was a control freak, he was very indecisive, it took so long to get anything done.
Yeah, and that is something that Theresa May really does need to get a grip on very quickly. She's had an extended honeymoon period compared to most new prime ministers. There are some, based on the polling, it looks like she's had one of the longest kind of like honeymoon periods that a new prime minister's ever had. But honeymoon periods will run out.
Mm.
And, you know, it's, to be honest, it's only by the sheer fortune that she's going up against Jeremy Corbyn currently that they're able to maintain that strong position. May has very good ratings as being a good prime minister. Her favourability ratings are quite good. that doesn't necessarily mean it's because people like her. I strongly suspect a lot of it's because they're looking at Corbyn and kind of going, well, in comparison.
The final New Year's resolution for Theresa May that we've got is to get better at PMQs. Now, it was interesting going back to her first PMQs when she was Prime Minister in July and absolutely wiped the floor with Jeremy Corbyn. There was blood on the floor. Corbyn asked about workers with job insecurity and unscrupulous bosses at a time when he was in the middle of a leadership
election.
80% of Labour MPs had said they had no confidence in their boss. And May comes back with a zinger about a boss that doesn't listen to his workers and where workers are having to double up.
Sounds familiar.
And it was carnage. That has proved to be the exception, not the rule. Corbyn, generally, has had the better of Theresa May in the PMQ's encounters that they've had.
There's a couple of things behind that. One is just that Theresa May is not David Cameron, and David Cameron was very, very good at PMQs. As much as he was berated for being flashman and never answering questions and things like that,
he was good when he could keep his temper.
Yeah.
He never really quite learned to keep his temper, I think.
But either way, Cameron as a whole was quite slick at that kind of stuff. It very much fitted in with his skill set and his temperament. With May, it's a very different story. And I think unless there is something which has been meticulously planned for, and it's something which she's so comfortable with, she's never going to be able to pull off as many of those one-liners and those zingers, which tend to kind of almost define whether or not you win at PMQs.
Yeah, it's that 30-second soundbite you can play on the news.
Yeah, pretty much. But at the same time, I think the other issue is just that I think Corbyn's just gone better. I think his team have actually learned some of the lessons. I think they brought on some new people to help him out. I think Damien McBride's back in the inner circle now of
what, evil Brownites?
Yeah, I know.
And I think as well it's the type of questions he's using. So, well, for a start, he's asking more focused questions. So often he'll spend PMQs on a particular issue and explore that more in depth.
Which is more or less the way you should do it.
But still using those questions from the public, so he's still got that. And also he's asking them on things which the MPs can unite behind, because when Corbyn was first Labour leader, often the Labour benches behind him were in silence. Now he's asking questions on grammar schools, he's asking questions on the NHS, which Labour MPs can get behind, and he's getting more of the support from his party, given the amount of crises the government is facing at the moment.
It would be pretty impressive in its own way if he wasn't winning things at the moment.
So,
but then again, this is Jeremy Corbyn, so he always finds new ways to surprise us with his incompetence.
Shall we move on?
See, I was going to say, speaking of new levels of incompetence.
Jeremy Corbyn's New Year's resolutions. So,
let's start with the easy one, which is fire Seamus Milne out of a cannon.
Right, yes. Get a media strategy. Seamus Milne, Guardian columnist, Stalinist, Milosevic sympathiser, needs to be fired out of a cannon. One of the main reasons why Labour MPs tried to launch a coup against Corbyn after the referendum, it wasn't just because his office sabotaged the campaign. I think it's also because in Corbyn's first big test, in a first big national campaign, his media campaign was lacking.
Yeah.
So how it generally works is you brief the journalists the night before and you say you're going to have a speech on something, which means then the Today programme leads with Jeremy Corbyn is going to make a speech today on X. And then you go on the Today programme and you say what you're going to talk about and you say how important it is. Then you do the broadcast media and you do the interview to Sky, you do it to ITV, you do the BBC, and you say, I'm talking about this, it's important because of this. Then you stand in a room about 3-4 o'clock with all the media there and you say your speech.
Yep.
Then, because you've said it at 3 or 4 in the afternoon, it leaves the 6 o'clock news. Jobs are good. That wasn't what Corbyn was doing. What Corbyn was doing was appearing at 7-8 o'clock at night, doing lots of rallies across the country to 300 Trotskyists who agreed with him anyway, which is not how you run a big national campaign. There's been so many things about Labour's media strategy. The fact that they're sending press releases out after journalists need them so they're not getting in the papers. On the first weekend in January, there was no major Labour figure on any of the major interview programmes apart from a pre-recorded interview with Tom Watson because it was his birthday, in which he basically said, I don't know what Labour's immigration strategy is. There's a wonderful quote in All Out War where there's this idea that we're going to have a Labour campaign bus. And John McDonnell basically does not want there to be a campaign bus with Labour branding on it because he thinks it's a little bit too Alistair Campbell. It's a little bit too New Labour. I think there's almost this idea that decent media management is Blairite and we can't do anything Blairite.
Yeah, I mean, I mean, it almost goes without saying that if you've been following British politics, you can see that there's just distinct lack of Labour coverage. Now, the more conspiratorial of you may actually think, oh, it's mainstream media trying to cut out Corbyn and Labour. But in reality, it's because they're not actually getting the press releases out in time, because they do have this piss-poor media strategy. To Labour's credit, they seem to have been trying in the new year to actually try and kickstart this again.
Corbyn 2.0.
Corbyn the populist.
Return of the Jedi.
Fight kind of going in and, as you say, doing things seemingly the way they're supposed to. Corbyn... It was brief that Corbyn was going to give a speech. In that brief, it said that Corbyn was going to basically roll back on freedom of movement. Then Corbyn goes on to be interviewed by, I can't even remember.
I think it was John Humphreys on Today.
Yeah, rolling back from that position and says no. We're going to talk about how some workers are being exploited. It's like, okay, well that's not what the press release said. So that's already by about 9 o'clock. Your strategy's out the window.
And also lots of journalists get pissed off. You would be pissed off, listener, if you thought that this podcast was going to be about flower arranging and we started talking about Jeremy Corbyn, you would be quite pissed off as well.
Yeah. And then just to make things worse, Jeremy Corbyn then goes on to another show, gets interviewed about the economy, and then starts going on about how he's in favour of a maximum wage but doesn't have a number to put on it. Now that becomes the lead story of the day, that Jeremy Corbyn is in favour of imposing a maximum wage. Fucking daft idea. And then after that he rolls back on that, and what's actually the spin operation comes out and says no, actually he's in favour of wage ratios, which are a very different policy. All in all, a day which was supposed to be about Labour's position on immigration gets usurped by something completely unrelated, which they then have an absolute clusterfuck with.
It has led, though, to my what is probably going to be my favourite headline of 2017, which was on ITV, which said Jeremy Corbyn distancing himself from his own leadership relaunch speech, which I think
sums it up perfectly.
So the West Wing has a lot to answer for. There's an episode in season one of the West Wing, which I think is called Let Bartlett Be Bartlett. President of America, played by Martin Sheen, he's tanking in the polls, and Liam McGarry, his chief of staff, his strategy for how to relaunch Bartlett is let Bartlett be Bartlett. And the idea is that if you show you speak about what you're passionate about and you show the electorate your true personality, then truth will out, the forces of good and righteousness will prevail over the forces of evilness, insecurity and Republicans. The problem is that Jed Bartlett was a fictional Nobel Prize winning economist. And Jeremy Corbyn
is none of those things.
Sadly, is not fictional. And definitely has never won the
economics prize for the Nobel laureate. Yeah.
In fact, so there's this thing about let Corbyn be Corbyn. There's this rebrand of him as a left-wing Donald Trump.
Before we get on to that, Labour tried this with Miliband. For a period of his leadership, there was a let Miliband be Miliband strategy. Again, because as much as I like the West Wing, there is this almost romanticised idealism that somehow... That can be the reality of left-wing politics.
I think New Labour was obsessed with the West Wing, apparently. I think it's in Servants of the People, which is Andrew Rawls' first book on New Labour. The West Wing theme tune was on the antiphones, on the phones in Downing Street. So the West Wing has this kind of mythos, I think. A lot of what Bartlett's trying to do in it is triangulation.
Yeah.
You know, you keep your core vote and you try and appeal to swing voters. But those were heady days when Labour had a core vote that they could
grow on to actually win.
The wage cap, I think it sounds good for about a minute before you realise...
It would actually cut the tax rate.
Yeah, well, so it cuts the tax rate. If you're going to do it, you might as well have a very high marginal top rate of tax. Now, we could have that conversation about should we have a top tax rate of 80%, that famous socialist Margaret Thatcher, for most of her reign... Top rate of tax in England was about 75-80%. Also, it's kind of unworkable because the income of most rich people, it doesn't come from wages necessarily, it comes from rents, or it comes from capital gains. So you can talk about increasing corporation tax or capital gains tax.
Yeah, a wage cap is a wonderful thing to deal with income inequality, but income inequality in the UK has been falling. In fact, on the day or the day after that Corbyn came out with this whole I support a wage cap as a way to deal with income inequality, it was a report comes out from the ONS that shows it's been falling and has been falling for the past 5 years or something like that.
So it's a bad policy, it's unworkable, it wasn't what the speech was meant to be about anyway.
And yet it was.
I think we're agreed, media strategy It's starting to get there. Hopefully, basically, fire Seamus Milne out of a cannon, get an Alistair Campbell type figure, professionalise the media operation, it could get there. Mm-hmm. Okay? That's UK politics done, as I imagine we're going to be doing in some way or form in 2017. We will end up talking about Donald Trump, I imagine, much more than we would like. Before we do talk about what his New Year's resolutions would be, and I imagine that Donald Trump is the kind of self-reflective man who probably has made his
many New Year's resolutions improve and become a better Donald.
The best New Year's resolutions he has, the greatest resolutions.
He's going to succeed at all of the resolutions.
The media's resolution this year should be to find a way to stop reporting lies. There was a whole big of a problem last year with fake news. And it just so happens this week that BuzzFeed have given us our way to try and stop reporting lies, which is you take a dossier, we don't know if it's true, and publish it all in full.
Yeah, and so we're going to let the public decide. I think with this dossier situation with Trump, I think that a little bit of context is required. This document has been doing the rounds for months, pre-election, the US presidential election.
It wasn't passed to us, I'm afraid, listeners.
No, unfortunately.
But it was in other media outlets, wasn't it?
This dossier was produced as part of some opposition research against Trump in the Republican Party. It was produced by a former British spy called Chris Steele, I believe.
Yeah, apparently he did this research for Jeb Bush, and he was also contracted to help run the FA's World Cup bid, which are probably two of the more spectacularly failed campaigns in recent history. But
And then it gets handed over to those people. It doesn't really go anywhere. And at some point, Chris Steele, having done all of this research and kind of looking at it and looking at the things he's found about rumours of compromising material that the Russians have on Trump and things like
and
that.
And the Trump campaign apparently having contact with Russia.
Yeah, gets very nervous himself about this and starts working on it in his free time, completely unpaid.
Imagine discussing Donald Trump unpaid in your free time.
So he does all this unpaid and free time and eventually hands it over to the FBI. The FBI don't do anything with it. And again, he gets really nervous about this. And as do some of the other people that have also worked on it as well. There's another kind of oppositional research company. And they all hand it over to various people. And it starts doing the rounds. It ends up with the intelligence services in the US and I believe in the UK as well.
Yeah, and John McCain
gets a copy of it at some point and hands it over to the FBI as well. So the FBI definitely have a copy of this and don't do anything with it. Eventually, this thing gets to the media outlets because it gets leaked. Now, because none of this is verified, the media don't publish it. Most make kind of veiled hints at something. There are concerns that Russia might have something on Donald Trump. Yeah, but nothing really comes of it.
Yeah, Mother Jones, I think, allude to it, don't they?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Eventually, CNN decide to go a bit more transparent with it. They directly refer to the existence of this document that they have seen and have got a hold of. They do not publish the document. That causes waves in and of itself. BuzzFeed also have this document. And when, after CNN have already started talking about it, decide to publish it, thinking that, well, this is already news, but people don't actually know what the allegations are. So we can either publish the allegations or publish the document. We can't verify these things, so if we just publish the allegations, is that good ethic? Is that good journalistic ethics or bad? Is publishing the document good journalistic ethics or bad? In the end, they decide to just take a punt and publish it. All in all, what you have is BuzzFeed publishing a document which the intelligence agencies have had for months, the political establishment have had for months, the media has been referring to vaguely for months, but no one's actually actively been talking about it until CNN decides to do that.
And no one's actually sure if all of the details in it are true.
Yeah.
So it's very different to, say, publishing a speech in full.
Yeah.
And it's very different to, say, if government releases data on... the first thing that pops into my head is the government releases a database of all the schools that are going to have their built funding cut or something.
Yeah.
And, say, The Guardian says, we haven't got the manpower to sort out what's going on here. The government have published this.
So we'll just link to that.
Yeah, can you link to it? If you find anything that's interesting, email us, comment us, let us know.
Yeah, because you can't do that with when the allegations are that Donald Trump likes watching people take golden showers. But yeah, so all in all, this has sparked a massive debate about how to handle this sort of stuff, because with Trump, there's guaranteed to be a lot of innuendo and allegation. As a result, this has sparked off a serious question of how do you deal with Trump? Clearly, fact-checking didn't work. You can't ignore it. What BuzzFeed has done doesn't work either, because the public can't make their mind up on something like this because they don't have the intelligence to do so.
No, the journalist's job should be to verify information. I know it's the problem of the new media landscape we're in, where it almost feels like on the one side, you've got the New York Times, and they are proper journalists, and their whole thing is that they fact-check and they verify and they print facts, they print the news. On the other side, you've probably got people like us, who are two people recording in a nuclear bunker as a hobby. Now, we're very partisan, but we don't hide that fact.
No.
Hopefully we do it reasonably informed. You could even say you've got places like Breitbart and InfoWars.
Who are in that same kind of
thing. They're even more partisan. They don't have the high scrupulous ethics that we do. In that we hopefully wouldn't just make shit up. We at least try and report on stuff that's true. Where BuzzFeed is probably
somewhere in between.
Somewhere between us and the New York Times. They obviously have an editorial slant, but they're trying to be more journalistic as well. And
especially in regards to the political stuff.
Yeah, and they've got proper journalists who do that kind of thing, and they're quite entertaining. Almost, I think, because they are more partisan, because they have that slant, they've decided to try and print it in full. I think if they had this about Hillary Clinton, maybe they wouldn't have done.
Yeah, it's entirely possible with that that they might have done.
And I think the thing is that the media is meant to be... It's meant to verify stuff and make sure it's true, but it's also meant to set the context. Now, on Slate's Trumpcast podcast this week, there's a very interesting interview with Adam Schiff, who's a Californian congressman. He's a member of the House Intelligence Committee. An interesting thing he says is how the Hillary emails were reported. In that you end up basically talking about emails and hacked in a way that made the scandal sound a little bit worse than it was. If the media in every story said that emails which were obtained by the Russian government after hacking into Hillary Clinton's servers said this, or emails obtained by the Russian government in a hack to try and influence the election tell us that. And I think that's maybe the way to do it, is the media kind of forgot the context and just said Hillary email scandal hacking.
The media basically have fallen to the rise of clickbait, in effect. Everything needs to get people to read it, because, you know, people don't now buy the newspaper every day. If they do consume the news, it's through a website. And if it is through a website, they're not actually going on your homepage and then reading through it.
It may well be a news aggregator
aggregator, or for most people, it is just social media. It's whatever you follow. It's whatever comes into your feed through people retweeting stuff or sharing it on Facebook. And that's the same across every form of publishing. And because of that, they have to be more clickbaity. They have to try and grab people's attention. And at the end of the day, Russians have hacked and has revealed is a hell of a lot less sexy than Hillary Clinton's emails hacked. For me, at least, that's the issue. You have the journalistic ethics on one end of the spectrum and the need for revenue and eyeballs on the work so you can sell ads on the other.
I think it's also the fact that when something happens on the internet, it always feels a little bit less real. So, for instance, if the Russian government had actually broken into the Watergate building, broken the safe, took out a lot of documents from the Democratic Party and published them in a blatant attempt to influence the election, it would have been obvious what they did and what their motive was.
Yeah.
But because it happens online, people don't appreciate just how scary this is.
Yeah, and I think there is also the element that it comes through an intermediary via WikiLeaks, which, as much as I think Julian Assange is an absolute knob end of the highest order, started off as a place which was, you know, a bastion of freedom of information and things like that. It's still got that with some people, which means that image with some people, which means there's an element of people who are willing to believe that this couldn't possibly be because they trust Julian Assange. Now, the fact that those people are clearly idiots, in my mind, is a separate fact. But overall, that intentional blurring of the lines by the Russian government of handing it over to WikiLeaks and Julian Assange makes it even trickier for people to actually kind of get to grips with what's happened, because there's a layer of deliberate obfuscation in there.
That is the media. God help them, I think, in America. It's going to be an interesting 4 years. Donald Trump, then. New Year's resolutions for Donald Trump. We're nearly there. So, first one.
Stop tweeting. Do we need to explain that? I don't think we do. It's obvious why he shouldn't be tweeting.
Yes. Build that wall. Not that we think that the wall should be built. It's almost a symbolic thing where even if it's a fence, there needs to be some form of wall built.
Yeah. It's not just on that. He needs plans in place so that he can start deporting illegal immigrants. He needs to actually start putting in some way of draining the swamp, which if you actually look at a number of his picks to cabinet and kind of sub-cabinet positions, well, actually something like 8 of them are from Goldman Sachs, which if you ask most people, they would argue that that is certainly part of the swamp.
It's pretty swampy. Appointing your son-in-law as an advisor is pretty swampy.
Yeah. And again, this is just one of the issues that Trump is going to have, or potentially going to have, come the midterms, and the Republicans will as well, in that if it looks like a number of these things haven't happened. If there's a series of conflict of interest issues with some of Trump's picks, it doesn't matter if Trump isn't, you know, able to be hit by the conflict of interest laws. His cabinet can.
Mm.
And if they get hit by them, then, well, you said you were going to drain the swamp, Donald. Why have you chosen people who have clearly been diddling the system?
The big thing the conference was meant to be about on Thursday was Trump divesting himself of his business, which he hasn't done. It's going to be run by his sons, which is a clear conflict of interest.
Yeah, absolutely.
And most specialists who know about this kind of thing seem to think he'll be in breach of the emoluments clause from day one.
Yeah.
And how that plays out is going to be fascinating.
Trump very much needs to try and find a way to at least give the impression that he's actually doing these things. It's one thing to run as a populist and rail against things. It's another thing to run as a populist and rail against things when you've got a record.
Mm.
Once he's got that record of anything, he's going to find it very, very difficult to actually do anything else and make the case of in the same way. And, you know, with most political figures, you know, there are ways around that, you know, because they've got messaging, they've got strategies and things like that, and they will kind of do a proper political campaign. Donald Trump just is Donald Trump. There's not much more else to him. He's a what you see, what you get person. And as a result of that, well, if he can't change it up, then he's going to end up failing, and that's going to potentially affect him and the Republicans in the midterm.
A good note to finish might well be that let Trump be Trump is not going to be a workable strategy for 2017.
You'd hope not.
We're going to put this episode out in two bits. We're going to be putting out on our iTunes feed a second part of this, where we'll talk about a couple of other issues that have come up in a week. So if you want to get that, please subscribe to us on iTunes or subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts. If you are on iTunes, if you could leave a review or rate us, that would be excellent, because that also helps us discover the show. Our theme tune is Plucky Good Times by Dave Depper and is from freemusicarchive.org. And the wonderful James Cram designed our logo, and you can find him at Twitter at James Cram. I'm at Paperback Rioter.
And I'm at Centre Radical.
And we're going to be publishing news articles and more reactions on the week's news on our website, notenoughchampagne.com. We'll be back next week, and we're going to be talking about Barack Obama's legacy. See you then.
Bye.
Writing about that speech on our website.
Website. That's I know we're not quite up to the quality of the New Statesman and the Spectator yet.
It's a Freudian slip. I suppose a website might be a Benite website, maybe.